are Locked On Giants, your daily New York Giants podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, New York Giant fans. Welcome to a new edition of Locked On Giants, part of the Locked On Podcast family, your team every day. My name is Patricia Traina. I cover your New York Giants for a bunch of places. You can follow all my work by following me on Twitter at Patricia underscore Traina, T-R-A-I-N-A. And one of the places I cover for, that you cover the Giants for is Big Blue View. And I'm actually happy to have on the show with me today a colleague of mine from Big Blue View. He's also, like me, he puts his work on a lot of places, and he'll tell you about where they are at the end of the interview. His name is Mark Schofield, and he is a really, really good analyst, especially when it comes to quarterback play, a must read. And Mark, delighted to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time.
Patricia, it's a joy to be with you. A huge fan of what you do everywhere you cover the Giants. It's always must read stuff, must listen to stuff. And I'm just so happy to be with you today, talk a little bit about the quarterback position.
Awesome. And we have a lot to talk about. It is a very hot topic for the Giants. And I think, Mark, we have to start with Eli Manning. You know, before we get to the young blood, let's start with Eli Manning. Now, I know you've done a lot of film study. You've done a lot of analysis and breakdown on Eli Manning. We don't know what the Giants have concluded as far as he's concerned. But what have you seen from Eli's play? Do you think it has slid, and or can he still play this game at a fairly high level?
You know, I think he's slid somewhat. And I remember when I was on with you before last year's draft, and I sort of made the case that, look, you could still run a functional offense with Eli Manning. You don't need to draft a quarterback in last year's class. And I sort of made that case, having studied him, you know, 2 years ago. And then when you see the way he played the position this year, I think part of it, there was a feeling out process with the offense. And I know early in the year, there was a lot of consternation, a lot of gnashing of teeth, for example, but myself included, when it seemed like there were opportunities in the downfield passing game, but Eli, and perhaps this was due to what he was being told to do, was more conservative with the football when he had some options down the field, seemed to check the ball down. But then sort of midseason, maybe it started with that Tampa Bay game, they got a little bit more aggressive downfield, and you saw some effectiveness. And so I think that there is, you know, a slippage to a certain extent. I think that the Giants could still be a functional offense next year if they decide to stay with Eli, whether they, you know, look to him now as a bridge quarterback to a guy that they potentially draft or this year or next. But the question is going to be one of how effective can they be? What is the ceiling with Eli Manning as their passer next year? You know, I think if they involve Saquon Barkley more in the passing game as a receiver out of the backfield, his talent is perhaps unparalleled at the running back position, a dual threat running back. Too early in the year, I think they used him behind the line of scrimmage on passing plays. They should involve him downfield a little bit more. You know, I think this can be a competitive team and win some games. The question becomes, what's the ceiling? And so I think that's what Dave Gettleman and company need to figure out. He could still do some things at a fairly high level. I like there are times when he makes some anticipation throws. I think the velocity, while it might have dipped a little bit, I think it's still enough to be effective in the National Football League. I'm not a huge velocity guy. I think it is more of a minimum threshold to hit, and he still surpasses that. And of course, there were some mistakes as well. You know, you look at an interception he threw against the Eagles where he misread the coverage and got, you know, baited into making a mistake sort of just on the cusp of the red zone, I think is an example of that. They have to decide, though, what is our plan post-Eli? Because that day is coming, and it might be coming at some point next year, or if not next year, at least the year after. And are they going to wait, or are they going to at least get a guy in now that they have in place for 2020 to be the starter, to fully take over? Or are we going to see perhaps a more Flacco, Lamar Jackson path where if the offense does struggle a bit, you've got talent around the quarterback position. You can have somebody that you get in this year's draft that can still be successful. You can still win games and perhaps even make a playoff run while transitioning to that quarterback sooner than you might have wanted to.
Mark, a lot of people say that, you know, Eli has to have everything perfect around him. Now, I believe, and tell me if I'm wrong, but every quarterback needs to have protection. Every quarterback ideally needs to have guys who can, you know, separate down the field. Every quarterback needs to have a decent running game that might, you know, give a defense pause. When you think of terms of Eli Manning, does he maybe need closer to perfection to be effective, or you know, given what he has, can he, you know, in other words, how much of it was on him? How much of it, especially early on in the season, was a result of him not having that running game on a consistent basis, not having the protection from the offensive line, and not having receivers other than Odell Beckham Jr. who could get open on any kind of regular basis?
I think a good way to frame a response to that question is this way. Let's take a look at Aaron Rodgers, okay? Mm-hmm. One of the greatest quarterbacks of all time and one of the most talented quarterbacks in the game right now, somebody that people will point to as a sure thing, first ballot Hall of Famer. But when you look at some of the struggles that the Green Bay Packers had over, say, the past couple of seasons, there was a stagnation in offensive design. Receivers were struggling to separate. There was an overwhelming emphasis on the pass game, which took the run game out of it. And Aaron Rodgers was asked within the structure of that offense in so many instances to just create. And when you don't have those pieces in place, even a talented quarterback such as Aaron Rodgers will struggle. If the receivers aren't separated, you need to make perfect throws. If the route designs aren't such that receivers don't get open quickly enough, you have to rely on the quarterback to create outside of structure. And when you see Aaron Rodgers struggle to do that, you realize that any quarterback is going to struggle to do that. And so, you know, all quarterbacks need a little bit of help. I host the Locked On Patriots podcast. I've been a Patriots fan mostly my entire life. You know, when I was younger, I grew up wearing number 16, so I kind of liked Joe Montana. But I can tell you that in the structure of the Patriots offense, even though Tom Brady might be the greatest of all time, he's playing in his third straight Super Bowl, Josh McDaniels does a ton to help him and help his offense and put him in a position to be successful, whether it's pre-snap motion to help him identify the coverage, whether it's, you know, short motions to get a guy like Julian Edelman into a stack alignment so he doesn't get jammed off the line of scrimmage, which gives Edelman a chance to get open so Brady can find him, whether it's keeping Robert Gronkowski, perhaps the best receiving tight end ever, into chip and pass protection to give Brady extra time. And so all quarterbacks need help. Yes, there are some that can create off structure from here or there, like Patrick Mahomes, like Aaron Rodgers, but you can't do that on a consistent basis. And so expecting perfection from a quarterback, we'd all love to have the perfect quarterback plan for our teams, but all quarterbacks need help. And Eli Manning is no exception, nor are the Aaron Rodgers, the Tom Brady's, and even the Patrick Mahomes of the world.
When you look at how the Giants ran their offense this year, where could Pat Shurmur potentially give Eli Manning more help if they stick with him? You know, regardless if they take a youngster, you know, they'll probably stick with him until a youngster is ready. So where can they give him more help in terms of the scheme and in terms of what they're asking him to do?
You know, I think that what the Giants need to do is sort of strike the balance between the weapons that they have that are sort of vertical passing threats, such as Odell, such as Evan Engram, a player I love, and strike that balance between sort of a vertical passing game and an ability and to get the ball out quickly from Eli Manning's hands. Not so much checkdowns, but just giving him some opportunities to make some quicker throws. So if you're still sort of sorting out the protection issues, which the Giants did have early in the season, you minimize that risk and that exposure. And you look at the way that Andy Reid has sort of constructed his offense. We all think of Andy Reid as, you know, the prototypical West Coast offensive mind. But yet with Patrick Mahomes, with Tyreek Hill, with Travis Kelce, they've become more vertical at times. You have that balance. You do some different things schematically that stretch the defense from sideline to sideline. You use motion. You use different alignments to get guys some free releases to give Eli Manning those pre-snap cues, which will enable him to make quicker decisions. Those are the ways that you can help your quarterback. Look around at what Reed does, at what, you know, Josh McDaniels does, at what Sean Payton does, you know, borrow from Sean McVay at times. You know, the usage of motion and pre-snap movement does so much to put sort of the doubt in the mind of the defense. You know, anytime, and look, I'm an old quarterback, I'm an old offensive guy, I firmly believe that anytime you make the guys on the defensive side of the ball have to think before the snap, you've got the advantage. And so these are the things I think they can do to sort of give Eli that pre-snap advantage, put his players in position to succeed, and then, yeah, strike that balance between using the vertical threats that you have, but then still doing some things to get the ball out of his hands quickly.
In terms of the talent they've begun to assemble, you know, the Saquon Barkleys, adding Nate Solder, Will Hernandez, you know, Sterling Shepard, Odell, all those guys, you know, a lot of people say, you know, the Giants are building around Eli. Do you see them as building around Eli, or are they basically putting together a good foundation regardless of who the next quarterback is and what skill sets he brings to the table?
I think it's more the latter. I think that the trend in today's NFL is to, you know, if you have a quarterback – who's a great quarterback, who's perhaps among the elites. You hold on to him for as long as you can. But we're also seeing this other trend that perhaps the biggest competitive advantage you can have in the NFL is a rookie quarterback playing well on his rookie deal. And because of the CBA implications, it's relatively inexpensive, so you can assemble talent around them. Look at 7 of the 12 playoff teams. You know, obviously the Eagles have a bit of an asterisk because Wentz was hurt, but 7 of them had rookie quarterbacks on their rookie deals, Mahomes or, you know, Watson or Lamar Jackson. And so you could assemble the talent and then be successful enough with the quarterback that is in place. But it also happens for the veterans. You look at how the Patriots drafted last year. What did they do? They draft an offensive lineman in the first round, and they draft a running back in the first round. That running back, obviously, a very un-Belichick type move. He doesn't often go offensive skill player in the first round. But what did they do? They got an extra bit of talent around Brady to both protect him and to take some pressure off of him, giving him a running back that he can hand the ball off to. And we've seen that become beneficial as they've become more of a 21 personnel team, running the fullback behind, running, you know, Sony Michel behind the fullback in the power eye, looking more like my high school offense than what we've expected from Tom Brady. And so you can assemble talent around a veteran quarterback to help him be successful, but it also puts the talent in place to make that eventual transition. I think those two picks by the Patriots of Wynn and Michelle were a window into their future transition to life post TB12, and assembling the talent that the Giants have with, you know, Evan Engram, with Will Hernandez, with Barkley, obviously, is, yes, it can help you win now with Eli, but it also sets you up for that post Eli world.
And we're going to talk about that post-Eli world in just a moment. Folks, you're listening to Locked On Giants with Patricia Traina and special guest Mark Schofield. We're going to take a short break, come back, and we will turn our attention to some of those prospects. So do stay with us. Welcome back to Locked On Giants. You're with Patricia Traina and special guest Mark Schofield. He does an excellent job for Inside the Pylon, Big Blue View, and a whole bunch of other places he'll tell you about at the end of our segment. And we are talking quarterbacks on this Friday show. And Mark, let's turn our attention to the prospects in the draft class. I want to cover them because I get a lot of questions about, you know, the Dwayne Haskins, Kyler Murray, you know, all the prospects. Tell me from your perspective to start off, is this a good quarterback class? You know, everybody's obviously looking at last year's class where they said, you know, that was a really good one. Is this class as good as last year's?
Well, first, let me preface it by saying that I am a card-carrying member of the quarterback union. So every year when the arguments come out that this is a bad quarterback class, I'm the first to don the armor, pick up the sword and shield, and defend the honor of the quarterback class because it's what I have to do. Is it as talented a class as last year? No. I don't think we're going to see 5 quarterbacks come off the board in the first round. And in last year's draft class, we had some quarterbacks, you know, whether it's Sam Darnold, whether it's perhaps Baker Mayfield, that you could point to, you know, and say that, look, these might be the generation type guys that come along once in a long while, similar to the, you know, the Andrew Lucks of the world that you can hold on to for dear life because if you get them, you hold on to them. That being said, with the move in the NFL towards trying to maximize those rookie deals, with the recognition by some personnel departments and coaching staffs that the 3-year developmental window for a quarterback is out the window, so to speak, because of the competitive advantage of having an effective or at least competent rookie quarterback and then building around him, there's more of a trend to getting these guys in, working around their skill sets, building an offense around what they can do well. I mean, look at the Ravens and how they use Lamar Jackson. They decided that, look, which is basically going to run like a Big 12 zone read type offense, and it got them to the playoffs. There are quarterbacks in this group that I think, while not quote unquote pro ready, they're going to be ready enough to play in today's NFL. There are some guys that I think do some things very well. I think it's also a surprisingly deep group. I think if this is a year, and this might not be the Giants, but if you're a fan of another team, say the Chargers, say the Patriots, that might need a quarterback and say 2 years down the road and you have some time, there might be some guys in that sort of late day two, early day three type range that could turn out to be very good quarterbacks. And so, does it lack the star power at the top of last year's class? Definitely. Are there some starting quarterbacks in the NFL for next year and beyond in this group? I think that's true too.
Okay, so let me ask you about a couple of names I keep hearing about. Let's start with Dwayne Haskins. Now, the big knock on him is that he's only had 1 year as a starter at Ohio State. Some people say he's a system quarterback. What do you see when you look at Dwayne Haskins' film?
Well, I think, you know, and again, being a Patriots fan, I've had to, sort of defend the system quarterback tag or push back on that for a long time now because it's a criticism of Tom Brady. And I always say that all quarterbacks are system quarterbacks. I mean, all quarterbacks are tasked to run a scheme. And when you evaluate a quarterback, whether it's a quarterback coming out of college or a potential free agent, part of the job of any NFL scout or, myself or the media is to find the sort of traits that they have, what they do well, how they win, and what system is best suited for them, and then try to get them into that kind of system. And so with Haskins, is he a system quarterback in a sense? Yes. He's not an athletic quarterback. You're not going to design sort of, Baltimore is not going to have him run the kind of offense that they were running with Lamar Jackson. He's not that type of quarterback. But there are some things that he does well as a passer that I think will translate to the NFL game. He has the arm talent, the velocity, and the placement to all levels of the field. He's more of that prototypical pocket passer. I would like to see him get a little bit better in response to sort of quick pressure at his feet and in the interior, but that's an issue that all quarterbacks have. That's the book on stopping Tom Brady and every other quarterback in the NFL. If you get quick interior pressure on them, they sometimes struggle. I would like to see him sort of handle pocket presence and pressure better, but I think even with the 1 year as a starter, he's done enough where I would point to him as, not having not finished all of my work on these guys, I think he's probably the clubhouse leader for quarterback one.
So Mark, one of the knocks, I guess, against Haskins is that he's been a system quarterback, a guy who can only function within a certain type of parameters. I mean, do you see that when you break him down on film?
Well, it's a great question. And, I'll preface it by reminding everybody that, look, I'm a Patriots fan. I host the Locked On Patriots podcast. And so I've spent a lot of time and energy and perhaps maybe more so than I should, pushing back on the idea of a quarterback being a system quarterback, because I've often said that all quarterbacks are system quarterbacks. When NFL scouts study quarterbacks, what they do is they evaluate the traits and then they try to project them into an offensive system. So, that's part one of the process. And the other thing to remember is, so many offenses these days overlap in terms of systems and what they're running. It used to be that Andy Reid, he's going to run a West Coast offense, and Bruce Arians, he's going to run an Eric Coryell offense. And so it's going to be wildly different amongst these systems. Now, look, everybody runs mesh concept. Everybody runs a three-level read. Everybody runs four verts. There's such overlap in systems that even if a guy just fits one sort of scheme box system, he's going to be successful in almost any offense because of the overlap between offensive systems. And so if you look at a guy, whether it's Haskins or anybody else, and say, look, he's just a system quarterback, that can still work for almost every single offense in the NFL today because there's no one system that teams are running. And so that's one way to look at him. When I study Haskins, what stands out to me first is the velocity, the arm talent, the ability to make throws to all levels of the field. He checks those kinds of boxes, which we all know NFL teams like to see checked off first. Are there things I would like to see him improve upon? Yes, I think he needs to get a little bit better in response to pressure. There are times when he will often look to sort of exit the back door. He's not the most athletic quarterback, so sometimes that gets him into trouble. He thinks he can do things that maybe he's not suited to do, whether it's scrambling, whether it's trying to extend plays. The rare times on film where you see him sort of click and climb the pocket, for example, he had a couple throws in that fourth quarter against Penn State in that comeback where rather than had he, a couple of times earlier in the game, he was trying to exit the pocket and roll out to his right and he was getting sacked or forced to throw it away. Then in the fourth quarter, he started climbing the pocket. You can see it almost click in his mind that, oh, he's going to become, once he figures this out, he's going to be a dangerous quarterback once he figures out his limits from an athletic profile and starts to learn how to manipulate the pocket more like Tom Brady than Lamar Jackson. You could see him start to put it together. And so does he have a limited number of starts in college? Yes. Is that sort of a prerequisite to success or a bar to success, rather? I don't think so. The Parcells rules are kind of out the window with how many quarterbacks leave early. We've seen Mitchell Trubisky have a relative amount of success with just 1 year as a starter. And so I think that when all is said and done, my work on all of these guys isn't completed, but I think he's the clubhouse leader as quarterback one in this group.
Okay. And then another quarterback that obviously is making the waves or making the rounds, his name is Kyler Murray, a lot of people seem to like. What is it about Murray that's so attractive, and where are his shortcomings?
With Murray, what's attractive is a lot of the things that gets people excited on Twitter and elsewhere about Patrick Mahomes. It's that baseball background, which oftentimes, you know, people would focus on passive mechanics and say, look, there's one way to throw a football. And we've kind of seen that sort of go by the wayside as we see the ability to sort of drop that arm angle and make throws from a variety of platforms is sort of becoming what you need to do at times in the NFL, because with so many athletic defensive ends and even athletic interior defensive linemen, like say the Aaron Donalds and the Chris Joneses of the world, you've got to have that ability to sort of make some throws off structure and off platform and have a lightning quick release. And baseball players have that with how they play that sport. And so Murray's ability to make throws like that is eye-popping at times. And you see that game against Alabama where he makes that throw deep downfield, down the middle, with his feet basically off the ground when he releases it. He looks more like Derek Jeter turning or making that deep throw from the hole in the shortstop position over to first. It's hard not to get excited about that. He's a lightning-quick athlete. He can make some throws that, like I said, are eye-popping. And he certainly fits the trend of where the NFL seems to be going as more and more college offenses infiltrate the NFL with players with his skill set and background coming into the league, and coaches like the Kiff Clinsbury's of the world getting head coaching jobs who are going to be running these types of systems. And so there's a lot that he can do in today's NFL. But, you know, my fears with him are a couple. You know, obviously there's the, look, this is the kind of offense that he was running. Can you make that effective in the National Football League on sort of a full-time basis? Or are you going to have to incorporate some of the more quote-unquote pro-style things that teams often use? So there's that issue. There's the fact that, look, can he fit the ball into the tighter windows you're going to see in the National Football League? Does he have it from a mental standpoint? Because remember what we said about Baker Mayfield running that offense. Yeah, he's not making a lot of tight window throws. I mean, he's throwing to a lot of wide-open receivers. We saw it work for Baker. Probably could work for Kyler Murray, but we need to see more proof of that. And finally, there is the risk that comes with drafting, say, a sub 5 foot 10 inch, you know, sub 200 pound quarterback. I mean, you are banking on the ultimate outlier, perhaps. And I just get back from the Senior Bowl, and a lot of the talk in the stands was, look, the biggest, most important place for Kyler Murray at the combine isn't at throwing drills. It's not at the interview podium. You know, it's not in the hotel suites meeting with teams and going over blackboard stuff. It's on the scale. Because if he steps in and somehow measures in at 5'10 and say 200, that gets you into the more Russell Wilson realm, where at least you can say and point to an outlier as a GM and say, well, look, this guy won a Super Bowl. We can win with this size profile. But if he does come in at, say, that sub 5'10, which is SID over at Oklahoma said he's 5'9 and 7'8, and he's looking, you know, weighed in at about 188, that is banking on more the Doug Flutie type outlier. And that's a risky decision for general managers who tend to be a risk-averse lot. And so that might be the ultimate concern for him, is that he's an immensely talented quarterback and he might fit where the NFL is trending offensively, but he might be perhaps just a year or two ahead of his time.
Interesting. And then there's a bunch of other quarterbacks that have been mentioned, some of whom I know participate at the All-Star Games. There's Drew Locke, Daniel Jones, Will Greer. When you look at some of these other quarterbacks, is there one that kind of jumps out to you that maybe screams Giants future?
It's interesting. You know, going into it, you know, the Senior Bowl, for example, I might have thought that the guy out of that group might have been Daniel Jones, because when you study him on film, I liked a lot of what he did sort of in the quick passing game. I think he's a quote-unquote, you know, West Coast kind of specific guy, but had enough arm talent where you could see him make some downfield throws, and so you could see him do some different things schematically and fit some different systems and be a somewhat scheme-diverse quarterback. But, you know, Patricia, he had a very bad week down in Mobile. I mean, we were not allowed access to the Wednesday practices. They were closed due to weather. They just had enough room in the practice bubble, you know, for media, for NFL personnel, and just two per team. So I finally didn't get any chance to watch his Wednesday practice until that night at the main hotel, you know, studying the practice film. And during the 7-on-7 sessions, again, no defensive line, no pass rush. It's the second day of practice, so you've started to get on the same page with the offense you're running and, you know, the receivers you're throwing to. And he's being coached by John Gruden, which is a, you know, West Coast guy, so it's the type of offense you'd expect him to be good at. And his first three throws, one was a speed out to the left that he missed wildly on. One was a check down to the left, which was the right read, but he waited, you know, 3 minutes, it seemed like, before he finally threw it, and he got pick sixed. And then he threw a comeback to the left along the sideline that he stared at, double clutched twice, saw his receiver fall down, threw it anyway, and he got a pick sixed. And you're just like, okay, well, I guess this might not be the first round quarterback that we expected to see down here. And so, you know, he's got a big week ahead of him once we get down to the combine. I think he's going to need to do a little bit more work. Locke, I think he's more of a vertical passing quarterback, ran a simplified offense for the past two seasons ago and then a year ago. It was all sort of like Baylor's offense. But then they bring in Derek Dooley. There's some more stuff over the middle. So you see a little bit of growth in him. I think he's worked on his footwork. He's worked on his release point. And I know I just got done saying mechanics don't matter, but his were a mess. Said all the right things at Mobile, apparently crushed it during the media interviews. And so it seems like his stock is rising as we get out of the Senior Bowl. As for Greer, I love his competitiveness. You know, he spoke in the post-practice scrum after the first practice on Tuesday, basically said that I'm the best quarterback in this class. And you like to hear stuff like that. You want these guys to be confident in themselves. You know, he was asked about his relative lack of arm strength compared to some of the other guys. And he said, you know, ask anybody I've ever played with, whether it's at Florida or, you know, at West Virginia, or ask about the people I've played against. I've got the best arm in this group. And somebody turned to him and said, well, does that mean you're throwing up the combine? And he just turned and looked at them straight in the eyes and said, absolutely. So I love his confidence. His performance, however, was mixed. I mean, the practices were a little bit shaky. Did he get into the game, and his best throw was basically a roll out to the left that he just threw up for grabs, and luckily Hunter Renfrow came down and made a catch for him. So I think he's probably going to be more of a day two guy. He had the potential to slide into day one, but I think teams are kind of going to shy away from him. But, you know, so with those three guys, I would stack them probably overall, Locke, Jones, then Greer. Jones might be the better schematic fit, but I think he needs to do a little bit better in Indianapolis for me to feel more comfortable about him in the first round.
And I was just going to ask you, how much does the All-Star game showing actually affect a guy's stock? Because I'm thinking that's only part of the equation. You know, there's the college tape, and I think that's where probably GMs put most of their, you know, their attention on. So realistically speaking, Mark, how much could the combined All-Star games affect a guy, you know, as he moves forward in this process?
I mean, here's the sort of dark secret about the Senior Bowl week itself. You've got 3 days of practices, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then you've got the game on Saturday. The first day of practice, it's packed in the stands. There's tons of people there. Wednesday practice packed, whatever. Even though it was rained out this year, there were still tons of people in Mobile. You get out to practices Thursday, and it's empty. Everybody leaves town basically Wednesday night because they see what they want to see in the first 2 days. And if your sort of evaluation process takes a quarterback from, yes, a seventh-round guy to a round-one guy based on what they do in the Senior Bowl or how they look at the combine, throwing in shorts and a T-shirt, you have to sort of revisit how you evaluate positions, whether it's quarterbacks or others, because you can, you know, tweak a guy and move him, say, from a couple of rounds here and there based on how you see them performing in these atmospheres, because these are sort of job interviews. And if you see some things that you don't like, or you hear some things that you don't like when you meet with these players, you might sort of reshuffle the board a little bit. But we can't ignore 2, 3, maybe just one, but all these years of tape and what they've done, because – you know, yes, there will be some instances, like, for example, Jared Stidham, where that Auburn offense might not have been best tailored to him. He looked great down in Mobile, so you maybe sort of revisit his film. And, you know, maybe did I miss on a trait here or there? But ultimately, it's the film evaluation that is going to guide your evaluation process and your ultimate determination on where these guys should rank and how they should project to the NFL.
You're listening to Locked On Giants with Patricia Traina, special guest Mark Schofield. We're going to take our final break. When we come back, we're going to turn our attention to the free agent class of quarterbacks. So do stay with us. Welcome back, Giant fans, to Locked On Giants. You're with Patricia Traina and special guest Mark Schofield. He writes for Inside the Pylon, Big Blue View, and a bunch of other places he'll tell you about in just a little bit. But before we do, we're continuing our discussion on the quarterback class. Mark has talked about Eli Manning. He's spoken about the rookie class that's coming up in this year's draft. And Mark, let's touch a little bit on the free agent class. And not a very, you know, strong class. I know Nick Foles is a guy a lot of people mention as a potential for the Giants. I've heard people mention Teddy Bridgewater, who I don't think gets out of New Orleans. A couple people have asked me in the past about maybe trading for Jacoby Brissett. Is there a guy out there that, you know, A, realistically would fit in with what the Giants are doing, and B, is gettable?
You know, it's interesting because the two guys that I'm most excited about in sort of that free agent slash trade group would be Bridgewater and Brissett. You know, Foles, I know, is going to get sort of a big time contract because, look, he's been a Super Bowl MVP. You see what he did this past season with stepping into a situation where Wentz was hurt again, winning a bunch of what were basically playoff games for the Eagles just to get them into the playoffs. And then, you know, they win their wild card game under him. But I think he's more of that quarterback that you maybe win with rather than win because of. So for that reason, if it's going to take a big payday to go out there and sign him, I'm not so sure he's the guy you kind of break the bank for. So I'm more excited about the other two, Teddy Bridgewater and Jacoby Brissett. But the way you framed it, Patricia, is perfect. Are they gettable? With Bridgewater, I'm not so sure. Yes, you know, it seems Sean Payton loves Taysom Hill, you know, uses him a ton as sort of this, like, you know, Swiss Army knife type player. Well, he'll have him line up a tight end. He'll have him line up a wide receiver. They'll run some packages with him under center. But I do think that when the post-Breeze era arrives, Taysom Hill sort of stays where he is, and they build the offense around Teddy Bridgewater. That would seem to make more sense to me as a plan. So like you said, I'm not so sure he gets out of New Orleans. As for Brissett, I really like Jacoby Brissett. I liked him when he was coming out of NC State. Obviously, you know, he was drafted by the Patriots, partly because, you know, the voucher that he got from Bill Parcells, of all people, who spoke highly of him. I think that sort of helped him get to New England. You know, he won a game for New England on a short week when Garoppolo got hurt and Brady was suspended against Houston. They were basically kind of running a modified wing T, but it worked. And then he gets traded to Indianapolis basically before the season starts into a bad situation with Andrew Luck being hurt. Steps in week two as the starter. And yes, they didn't win a ton of games, but performed admirably enough that, you know, you could see that there were some good traits in him as a quarterback. Then this past year, he took on almost a leadership role. I mean, that team started with such a bad start. They have that players only meeting to sort of try to right the ship. And he was the driving force behind that meeting. He was the one that sort of put it into motion. And he's the backup quarterback. And so I think with, you know, the leadership role that he somehow provided to the Indianapolis Colts, coupled with the fact that, look, Andrew Luck had a great sort of comeback season. He might be comeback player of the year, but he's one awkward hit again from having that shoulder re-injured, and you're going to need a backup, you know, to step in. Who better than the guy who's already done it? And so I think it'd be tough to pry those guys away, whether it's via free agency or via a trade, you know. And what are you going to give up for Jacoby Brissett? If it's going to cost you a first-round pick or a second-round pick, maybe it's better to get a cost-controlled rookie in rather than, you know, a Jacoby Brissett.
Mark, I want to pose this question to you. It's a question I got on my show yesterday, and which was a Twitter Thursday question. I want to get your take on it. I was asked about, when you look at San Francisco, when they lost Jimmy Garoppolo and they put Nick Mullins in, and they were able to function with Nick Mullins. So the individual asked me the question, wanted to know, well, why couldn't the Giants function with, you know, Alex Tanney or Kyle Lauletta? Was it a matter of the coaching, or did the Giants just swing and miss on scouting them? And my response to them initially was the circumstances was different. You know, obviously Garoppolo suffered a season-ending injury, so they had no choice but to throw Mullins in there, whereas the Giants, you know, Eli was his usual Iron Man self. But still, we did get a chance to look at Lauletta, you know, a very limited selection. But when you did your work on him and Tanney and those guys, is it just a matter of they're just career backups, or what did you see in them, and can they be the answer moving forward?
I mean, I think there's always the potential that those guys, you know, Tanney and Lauletta, could be the answer moving forward. But, you know, these were guys that were going to need a little bit of work. I mean, specifically with Lauletta, and it's a big leap from the FCS level to the NFL. And yes, he had a fantastic Senior Bowl week, but there are always going to be some areas of his game, whether from, you know, an arm strength and velocity and placement standpoint to a process and speed standpoint. Because yes, against FCS level competition, and at sometimes during the Senior Bowl week, it looked like he had, you know, the mental part of the game figured out, but it's a whole different ballgame when you get to the NFL. You know, the speed with, you have to diagnose what a defense is doing and then get the ball out of your hands and make the right read and right throw. It's night and day, you know. And so I think that, coupled with what you sort of started with and how you framed your answer to it, with the fact that it's not a situation like where you had the Cowboys a couple of years ago, Tony Romo goes down, you have this, you know, quarterback you drafted in the fourth round, that it's not, well, maybe we can, you know, make it work with him. It's, we have to make it work with him. We don't have another option. We have to play a game in a couple of weeks, and somebody has to take the snaps. You know, so you're forced to sort of make it work. With Manning still being in place, and like you said, being his Iron Man self, they're not going to then, you know, try to build an offense around what one of those guys can do and make it work. There's no need to force it. They just sort of tried to make things, you know, work with Eli Manning as their quarterback. Had Manning gone down, I'm confident that Schumer and everybody would have been able to put together a game plan in place that might have been able to make one of those guys effective. But without the, you know, force in their hand, there was no need for them to do it.
Mark, we've often heard the coaching staff, the Giants coaching staff, talk about what's important in their quarterback, that they have a list. And I know Schirmer and Mike Shula, the offensive coordinator, have said that arm strength is not necessarily number one on the list. What is generally that list that people who are evaluating quarterbacks look for in terms of, you know, this guy's got it or this guy doesn't have it?
You know, arm strength is, I think, one of those traits that people should view it more as a baseline, as a threshold to meet. And as long as a player meets that, they can be effective in the NFL. I mean, you look at, you know, last March or so, I did a study on, you know, average depth of target, you know, in what NFL offenses are running. And, you know, two of the more successful quarterbacks, you know, a season ago, Alex Smith, Drew Brees, and you could actually put Jared Goff in there. Again, this wasn't, you know, this year that is just finishing up, but the previous season, 91% or so of their throws came within 10 yards of the line of scrimmage. And so the bulk of NFL offenses today are run within 10 yards of the line of scrimmage, maybe 15 yards of the line of scrimmage. So as long as the throw can be made in that area on time and in rhythm with enough velocity, you can be a successful NFL quarterback. And that's why we're seeing more and more teams sort of drop arm talent, arm strength down the, you know, down their list of traits that they look at. Unless the player is such an outlier in either direction where it's just eye-popping, you know, say the Josh Allens of the world. I think when you look at quarterbacks, there are sort of four things that you really sort of need to have. You need to have the game down from a mental point. And it doesn't mean that you have to be a quarterback that can come in and run an NFL pro-style offense from day one. It just means that you've shown the ability in your offensive system in college to make the right read quickly, process the information that the defense gives you, and get the ball out of your hands quickly. And guys like Mayfield, you know, running these spread type systems, they've shown the ability to do that. So I think that's first and foremost probably paramount for most NFL scouting departments. Then I think accuracy is one that is a big one, because if you know what to do with the football but can't put it where it needs to be, it's hard to build an offense around that. And so, you know, if you're the fastest processor of information but you can't hit the broadside of a barn, you're not going to make it in the NFL. And this doesn't mean purely completion percentage. There's completion percentage, there's accuracy, there's ball placement. There's all different ways to look at it. You might have a 70% completion percentage, but every throw makes the receiver adjust. You're not an accurate passer. You might have a 49% completion percentage, but you're running a downfield vertical-based offense, or you're getting a lot of drops, or, you know, whatever the reason might be. So you always have to sort of look at the film and see, look, can this guy put the ball where it needs to be, when it needs to be? There's pocket presence. You're going to face pressure in the NFL. You're going to have to move off the spot. You're going to have to handle life against the Von Millers of the world. How do you respond to pressure? How do you respond to, you know, getting moved off your spot when you have to set and reset your feet? How do you do in those moments? Because if everybody can throw from clean pockets all the time, there'd be 32 great quarterbacks in the NFL. But that's not life in the NFL. And so when you have to reset your feet due to pressure, how do you handle those moments? And finally, and look, this is the sort of quote unquote it factor. It might sound like a cop-out trait. It's one of those, like Justice Potter Stewart said, you'll know it when you see it, but competitive toughness. You know, when you get to life in the National Football League, you might be a 21, 22, 23-year-old rookie. You have to step into the huddle with 10, perhaps veterans, 10 guys who have been there for a while and been through the battles, looking back at you. And do those 10 pairs of eyes believe in you? Are you going to be that type of leader that inspires people to follow you? So there is that aspect to just being a leader and having that competitive toughness. And, you know, you look at a quarterback like, say, Deshaun Watson, you see him in the national championship game sort of diving in and getting helicoptered by Reuben Foster, perhaps Alabama's best defender, and popping right back up. That's a guy you want to play for, you know, as a teammate. That's a guy that you're going to go do superhuman things if you can, because you want to win for him. You see the way he's inspiring his teammates. And so you need to have that trait as well. And so those are the four, you know, Patricia, when I sort of study quarterbacks, that I kind of really keep an eye on. Do they check those boxes? Because if they do, I think they're going to be a successful NFL quarterback.
And then, Mark, I'm going to put you on the spot here. If you're the Giants, what do you do? Do you stick with Eli another year? Do you take his successor? If so, who? do you trade for somebody? What would be the ideal situation in your opinion?
I mean, I think that I will always come back to the quote from Bill Belichick when they drafted Jimmy Garoppolo. The Patriots, you know, in the years since they've had Tom Brady, have basically taken a quarterback every 2 years because Belichick, and he said this after they drafted Garoppolo, you know, replacing your quarterback is always one of those things. You'd rather be a year ahead of schedule than a year behind schedule because that might result in sort of a missed season. And everybody is very excited about the 2020 draft class with guys like Tua, you know, Jacob Eason, you know, Jake Fromm. There's a ton of people that could be in that draft class that could be great quarterbacks. Justin Herbert, who decided to stay in school. And you might get 4 or 5 first-round picks out of that class. You might see another name develop that we don't even know, like the Mitchell Trubisky of that group. But the thing is, development is never linear. We're expecting these guys that are going to be coming out next year to make these great developmental strides. They don't always make those strides. They're young kids. They're in college offenses, playing for college coaches. That they don't care about training these guys for life in the NFL. They care about winning an SEC championship or winning a national title. And so the development and the training that they're going to get and the coaching they're going to get at the college level might not produce that kind of leap. So it's always better to draft a guy and get him into your system. And if you don't need him right away, that's fine. But if you do need him, whether due to injury or ineffectiveness, you've got the guy and you can start working with him now. And so for me, I think it's time to draft a quarterback. I think it's time to plan for the future. And sitting here right now, don't hold me to it. I won't sort of chisel it into stone, but I think that guy would be Dwayne Haskins.
And then I one other follow up on that, because this, I just wonder how much of a factor this is going to be. The CBA comes to an end in 2020. There is growing talk that there will be a work stoppage in 2021. So from a timing perspective, does that also, I guess, accelerate the need to get Eli's replacement in now and give him an opportunity to learn? You know, you've got Eli under contract, you know, he's not going anywhere next year. I'd be very surprised. So does that accelerate the sense of urgency, knowing that there could be that work stoppage and you have to prepare for that on top of everything else?
I think that's a brilliant point. And, you know, it's one that I hadn't considered, but now that I've heard you say that, I think it definitely does sort of accelerate things. You know, you get your guy in now and you get the chance to work with him as much as you can, because if there is that sort of work stoppage, at least you've done some framework and some, you know, baseline work to get him ready to take over whenever that day comes.
All right. Interesting stuff. Mark, I'm telling you, I could probably talk another 2 hours with you. Not that it's been 2 hours here, but you're just such a wealth of information. Tell everybody where they can find all your work.
Well, again, thanks so much, Patricia, for having me on and for all your support for, you know, myself and Inside the Pylon over the years. It's an honor to be on here with you. I love all the work that you do. If people want to find me, they can follow me on Twitter at Mark Schofield. You can check out the work at places like InsideThePylon.com, Pro Football Weekly, The Score, Matt Waldman's Rookie Scouting Portfolio, and, of course, Big Blue View, part of the SB Nation family of websites. And if Giants fans are so inclined, they could always listen to me on the Locked On Patriots podcast.
And I promise you, folks, it's not bad. I know there's a lot of Giant fans who are not very, you know, keen on the Patriots, but Mark is definitely a must listen to. He's a must read. His work is phenomenal. Truly. I mean, I'm just amazed at the amount of information you drop.
Well, I thank you so much for that, Patricia. I always, you know, to hear that coming from somebody like you who I respect, you know, supremely in this business, it means the world.
Well, I thank you again for your time. Giant fans, that'll wrap up today's show. Make sure you tune in next week. We've got more guests coming. We're going to talk draft. We're going to talk Twitter Tuesday. We're going to talk about whatever you guys want. So make sure you tune in. And thanks, as always, for listening. For Mark Schofield, this is Patricia Traina signing off on Locked on Giants. Take care.